Throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going swell.
We're sitting here with Julia Marchesi.
Hi, everybody.
She is a director of a recent documentary that was released called Out of Print.
It's true.
And it's a pretty awesome documentary.
Oh, thanks.
Do you want to go into details of like how you came up with the idea of doing this documentary?
Sure. I used to work at the New Beverly Cinema, and we got a letter there from one of the major studios, and they had said that they were going to stop making production of 35 millimeter prints, which meant you would only be able to show things digitally. And the New Beverly is 35 millimeter only, so that it wasn't an immediate problem, but I saw it down the road it would be, and I thought that it was kind of ridiculous to switch over to a new format when it's not as good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I know eventually digital will look just as good as film, but it doesn't yet. And
yeah.
So I think it's preemptive and it's about money and it's kind of a drag. So I started a petition online to ask the studios to let their prints just remain available to Revival Cinema indefinitely, because I felt like Revival Cinema is very, very important to culture. And this petition got a lot of signatures and a lot of press. And so this kind of snowballed into, I'd always wanted to make a movie about the New Beverly because it's awesome theater and like there's an amazing, you know, group of clientele and there's a lot of really cool stories and stuff. But this kind of became the perfect time for it, because then it could also be this bigger story about how these places are kind of dying.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And there's a lot of revival theaters across the United States. Mm-hmm. People just don't know about them.
And that's the point of the film, really. Like the whole point is for you to watch it and go, wow, like, you know, there's this place down the street from me that I've never been that I should go try out, you know? And
right.
I think that's the thing that I've noticed, that if you know, I've showed it to people who have no idea about revival cinema, like they just, you know, that's just like a foreign world to them.
Right.
But then they see this movie and they're like, oh, that looks really great. Like, I want to give that a try now. And if the movie can do anything, that's what its point of it is. So
for people listening, what is revival cinema?
Revival cinema is showing older films, so classic films. So what the New Beverly does is it's a double feature setup. So they'll show two movies, and it would be either linked through the director or the actor or the style or the year or any number of things.
Right.
But it would go, you know, we would show Charlie Chaplin films, or you'd show Fellini's, you'd show Godard's, you'd show, you know, horror slasher. We have Grindhouse where you're showing, you know, Cannibal Holocaust and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's all over the map. And it's really cool because it gives you an opportunity to watch these films that you wouldn't normally get to see on a big screen with other people.
Yeah.
And for me, like, cinema's about the communal experience. And when you see a film like Cannibal Holocaust with an audience, it's completely different. It just turns, you know, there's so much energy in the room and people are going, ah, and just kind of yelling. And it turns the movie into this whole experience. And you know, when you say watch at home, it's not the same thing. So I really think that it's really important to go out and see, if you have an opportunity to see a movie that you've seen a billion times on the big screen, go see it, because it's going to be a whole different movie.
It definitely is.
Yeah.
By the way, Cannibal Holocaust is the second time that Cannibal Holocaust has been mentioned on the podcast, which is amazing, because I love that movie. I mean, as much as you can love something like that.
Yeah, I just watched it for the first time probably about a year ago at the New Beverly, and I knew it was going to be brutal. And I was like, you know, I've seen Last House on the Left. Like, I can deal with this, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, you can't kill animals on screen. That's really not cool. And like, and the thing that was creepy about it is like, there were dudes in the audience who were laughing when that was happening, and not like in a nervous laughing, like they were enjoying it.
Oh,
and
that's
like,
terrifying.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I've seen Cannibal Holocaust, never need to see it again.
Yeah.
Like, once and done.
Yeah. I think when I first saw it, I thought it was somewhat real.
Okay.
You know, it's like watching Blair Witch for the first time.
And based on true events.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it scared the crap out of me. And I was watching it in Indiana in this, you know, dark house.
How old were you?
I was 23.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to be like 8.
I was 8 years old.
We watched it at Christmas.
My parents were being locked up for neglect. Oh gosh, that movie is crazy. But when you were talking about watching a movie and having it a communal experience, my favorite movie that I ever saw at the New Beverly was watching Monster Squad with everyone. And just the fact that everybody knows the lines and the jokes and being able to talk through it and not be, you know,
that was belittled, that was an amazing screening because that was sold out. And I've been a big Monster Squad fan since I was a kid. And, you know, we got in contact with Fred Decker and he said he would come down and it, you know, it became this big thing.
Right.
And the second night, actually, Shane Black showed up.
Wow.
So, okay, so they wrote, directed together, and then I guess didn't get along after that, so they hadn't really seen each other for a while. But then they, like, got together at the Bev and talked, and so that was kind of... And, Black and Decker is just funny, so...
Yeah. Very true, very true.
It's kind of like a film school experience, though, because I know when I was in film school, you'd see these movies that you would never normally see. And then you talk about them afterwards.
Sure.
And it's like, especially for movies that are, like, you know, you can throw something on Netflix now and watch it by yourself and it's whatever. But if you're watching, you know, like a foreign film, like I remember one that stood out for me was The Bicycle Thief. And that was like a big, you know, discussion afterwards about this like neorealist movement of film. And like, it's weird that it has a really depressing ending, but it's still a really good movie. And it's, I don't know, it's more fun to be able to talk about stuff like that with the people that you're seeing it with. And
well, that's the point of revival cinema is to kind of make it be a community more than just you go to a multiplex and you buy your ticket and you go and you sit down, you watch a movie and you go home.
Yeah.
But this is something like you can talk to the staff, you can talk to the fellow, you know, the fellow customers, and it's cool and everybody's into it. And I think that that's something that's dying really fast. And I think it's really, really bad if it goes away because, you know, especially for people who are potential filmmakers, a lot of people that I interviewed for my film said that they went to revival cinemas when they were a kid. So they saw Chaplin on the big screen and Casablanca and all these films, and that made them want to be filmmakers. And so if you don't have that opportunity, what are your influences?
Right.
I mean,
the MTV generation.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, I mean, I'm an editor by trade. And, excuse me, like the MTV style of cutting, if it, you know, there's movies that have kind of influenced that, or I'm sorry, that the MTV generation has influenced movies and the way that they cut, and it's not as fluid a lot of times. And it's just interesting that the patience people have for films, like older films that are 2.5 hours long and people don't want to sit through them sometimes.
Well, I think that we've actually come around to a good place because you think about maybe 20 years ago and every film, 90 minutes, right? It's got to be 90 minutes. And now you have something like Interstellar, which is 3 hours. Or you have all the Lord of the Rings, which are all 3 hours.
That's
true. You're actually coming around to a place where I think people have a longer amount of patience and they're willing to sit through a longer film, even though they wouldn't used to. So I think it's good that like Hollywood's going back around to that and saying, it's okay. You can, you know, have as much as you want. I mean,
but it seems like stuff has to be happening for that. Like the older movies, you know, it could be the pacing was slower, so it's like it would be a really long movie, but you know, you'd have the same amount of story in 3 hours as now you would have in 90 minutes, but it's like people are having a long conversation or they're taking a leisurely walk, and it's like, you know, they want to cut around, they want to get past all that and just get to
cut to the action, cut to the action.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never even, I didn't think about that. Like, there are longer movies that people are actually enjoying, and people will watch The Lord of the Rings like 50 times.
Oh yeah, you got your all day.
Yeah,
I've done it.
The whole thing.
Everything extended versions.
Was that like 12 hours or something?
12 hours, yeah.
Wow.
The Two Towers gets a little rough. Like the ants show up and you go oh, but then like Return of the King brings it back. So
yeah,
how do you do that? Do you just sit down and?
There's lots,
do you take breaks between?
There's about a 10-minute break in between. There's lots of snacks.
Okay.
One of my friends does a themed snacks as well.
Oh.
So it's stuff like, you have my axe and my chips. Like, really? Like, Riders of the Maka Rohani and cheese? Like, that kind of really bad pun.
Right.
Oh, nice.
Right. I like it.
Sorry, we've kind of slipped. I don't realize.
Oh, no. our whole podcast is a big...
tangent.
Yeah, it's a big tangent.
So, Well, you were talking about the crowd that come into the New Beverly or Revival Cinema, and you talk about it in your documentary as well. You meet some of the people that are frequent
regulars.
Yes.
Yeah. The New Beverly in particular has a really interesting group of people, and what it is that you have these kind of mostly old men who don't have anywhere else to be. And so mm-hmm. they just make the New Beverly their home. Mm-hmm. And so it's a thing where you just go in and you just watch the movie, whatever it is. And that means sometimes you show up and we're showing Antichrist and I have to be like, just so you know. And, yeah. But most of the time they'll go in and give it a try anyway, even if they don't like it, they maybe walk out halfway through, but they're like, you know what? It's okay. I want to give you my $8. And like, that's the thing. So,
yeah.
But I feel like, you know, any Revival Cinema you talk to, there's going to be those people. That's the cool thing about it. It's like, you know, I went in the course of making the film, I went to London to film a bit at the Prince Charles Cinema, which is very similar and way cool. And they do sleepovers and they do all day, like,
super cool.
Like, you know, they'll do all day Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and like your ticket buys you a beer and a pizza and like, you know, like that kind of stuff. So, yeah. They have, you know, I talked to the guy who runs it, Paul, who's amazing, and he's like, oh yeah, pirate guy. Like, we have pirate guy. And I'm like, oh, we have apple juice guy. And it's like the same kind of, you know, all over the world.
Well, no, apple juice guy.
He just buys apple juice mainly.
And that's it.
It's not very exciting. No. Sorry.
It's more interesting than Steve.
Yeah, true.
Very yeah, well, true. We don't ever, like, a lot of times I don't know their real names. I guess I should have asked, but.
All right. Sure.
Do you think that there's, like, a... Because I know that it's big for film buffs to go or people that are regulars. Do you think there's is it difficult to get outsiders who normally wouldn't attend Revival Cinema to get into it?
That's the hard part about it, is that I think getting people to come see things they don't know what it is, mm-hmm. I think was the hard part. Something that I did at the New Beverly to get around that was we had a guest programming series. So we would have directors come in, and a lot of these directors were people that I got to interview in the movie. So Edgar Wright and Joe Dante and Stuart Gordon and Joe Carnahan and all these guys. And they would program a week of their favorite films and then talk about how those movies inspired them to be filmmakers. And so I think if you have someone like Joe Dante, who's incredible, and he says, like, come see this movie, and you don't know what it is, but you're like, well, Joe Dante has amazing tastes.
Right.
So then you give this, you know, it's an extra incentive to go see this film. Because I think that people, you know, are afraid to take chances, but what's the worst that's going to happen? You know, you're going to maybe see a movie you don't like very much. That's not the worst thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Maybe you'll see something that you'd never imagined that'll blow your mind, because I know in my years of working at the New Beverly, I saw so many films I'd never heard of that just were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I think that's the cool part about it, is you have to be willing to give weird movies a chance.
Well, yeah. that spurs on other things, like, oh, well, this director is really cool. Maybe I should see other films by him.
And yeah.
So on and so forth.
Is there a lot of foreign cinema that's shown?
They do everything.
Yeah,
bit of everything.
Okay. I really liked foreign films when I was in college, and it was normally something I would never, because people are like, oh, I don't have to read for 2 hours. Like, I'm watching a movie, so I don't have to do that. And then, but there's so many really good.
I kind of want to punch those people a little bit.
Well, like, we watched Let the Right One In mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, and then I watched it again, which was the original version, and it was like, I don't know, you're in a room with people who you think they're not going to have the patience to sit there and read subtitles for, you know, 90 minutes, and then everybody's just like shuts up and reads subtitles for 90 minutes.
Well, and I think there's been a lot of really cool foreign films that have been coming out. One that came out a few years ago that I really liked is Night Watch, mm-hmm. which is a Russian film, and it's a vampire kind of film. It's really incredibly cool, and also I don't know why other films don't do it. The subtitles like work with the film. So sometimes, like, there's a shot where one of the characters slams back against a wall, and like the subtitles break apart as if they'd hit the wall as well. Somebody's bleeding, and it'll like bleed onto the subtitles. It's amazing, and I'm like, why don't they do that for every movie?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Now I want to make a movie that does that.
Yeah.
Wow.
We just need to learn a different language.
Yeah.
Or make one up.
Or just make one up. Yeah. I did that once.
It's probably easier.
College.
You and Tolkien. You know.
Yeah.
could you tell us about, well, your film is actually, was it shot on film as well?
We raised money through Kickstarter, We raised $80,000 through Kickstarter. And
which is a feat all on its own.
Yes. Yeah, seriously. Yes. We should talk about that separately.
Which it sounds like a lot of money, $80,000. Oh, yeah. But then trying to make a film with it, actually not that much. So we actually got to Panavision donated a huge camera package to us.
Wow.
Kodak gave us some film, and we were able to shoot on 35. So
awesome.
We only did a few interviews in 35 and all of our like beauty shots of the cinema. But there is a split screen shot in the film, which shows you the difference between what digital looks like and what film looks
like.
That's cool. Because I think a lot of people don't know the difference.
Yeah.
But when you see them side by side, I think it really pops.
Yeah.
And then after the film, I was able to make a print. So Photochem was amazingly helpful, and DigiNeg, and they made a print for me. So
that's
because
incredible.
I felt like, you know, the, one of the movie's big points is, you know, 35 millimeter exhibition is so important. So I felt like kind of a fraud if I didn't have one.
Right.
But I also have a DCP and I have a Blu-ray. So, I mean, I'm all over the place.
That's awesome. But so, you have this tangible film.
It's in my house.
How much room does that take up?
Not too much.
Really?
They're heavy, but about a month ago, the Crest movie theater in Westwood asked if I wanted to show the print. So I got to show it, and it was the first time it had ever been played, and it was incredibly gorgeous, and it's a beautiful theater with, they have like stars that twinkle in the sky.
It's a great theater.
And it's beautiful, and they have a beautiful sound system and everything, and so I actually got to see it, which was really, really great.
That's so cool. I don't know what your life was when you were little, but like dreaming to make a movie and seeing it in the movie theater with tons of people and like, this is what I did. Like,
yeah,
that's incredible.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's cool that you have a print though, because not many people can say that nowadays.
And something that I've actually, I've been talking a lot with the moving image archivists. They work out of the New York Public Library, and they're really interested in the film in like this kind of educational kind of way, saying like, look, it's still viable and you can still do this. And there's, and so I think it's interesting that that side's been taken out, been coming out of it as well.
Yeah.
Not only like the revival cinema side, but also like, hey, 35 millimeters. So I'm glad that both have kind of been taken up.
Yeah.
It's like we had a director on a few months ago and she had just finished a feature and she shot it on digital because it's just, that's the money situation. And she says, I hate that it's just sitting on a hard drive in my house. Like it's just not the, cause she shot her first movie on film and.
Well, I think it's worth, you know, ask.
Yeah.
Ask Panavision, ask Kodak, because they were really, really incredibly cool to me and gave me a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think if you, you know, maybe they won't, but maybe they will.
I'm sure they're like, yay, someone's using our stuff.
Yeah.
Blow the dust off. Let's do this.
Well, they want to show that they're still around and that you can still do it.
That's very cool.
Can we talk a little bit about the Kickstarter thing? Because I know a lot of our listeners are, you know, people want to make movies and they don't have money, so they want to use Kickstarter. What was your success?
Okay, well, the things I can recommend to you, for starting a Kickstarter, I would say if you're going to promote, let's say you want to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So make a Twitter account, a Facebook account and all that for that film several months in advance of your Kickstarter and kind of get a following going so that you don't show up one day and be like, hey, everybody, give me money.
Smart.
Yeah.
So you have this following. And honestly, 75% of my money came from Twitter.
Wow.
So because it's something that, you know, if I tweet something and Kevin Smith retweets it, that's a million people seeing that tweet right there.
Right.
You have this huge, you know, spread of people seeing it. And I think that it's I'm afraid that Kickstarter is not going to be around for very much longer.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's really nobody watching to make sure you do what you say you're going to do with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're going to get that one jerk who's going to ruin it for everybody else who's going to get, you know, be like, I'm making this movie, guys. And we're going to give him like $100,000 and he's going to be like, peace out. And like, never see him again.
Yeah.
Don't be that jerk, guys.
Yeah.
Don't ruin it for everybody else.
So what was your method with the Twitter thing to get the following built that way?
We released, did like videos and we tried to do a video every week and you tried to keep, you know, and just really interact with the people who follow you. And if they, you know, if they retweet something to favorite them or say thank you and to really kind of have a constant, it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
It really is. Like 8 hours a day, you're on there constantly doing it.
Wow.
And But, you know, and you have to also remember that both Kickstarter and Amazon take 10%. Or they both take 5%, so there's 10% off the top right there.
Oh.
And also, keep in mind whatever your incentives are to add money for that on the top, because shipping is expensive, and if you're giving, you know, you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
So those are my advice.
And then for your actual Kickstarter page, what did that look like? I mean, did you have videos on there?
My Kickstarter video, through unfortunate circumstances, ended up being just me talking to the camera.
Okay.
And it was just me pleading my case and saying, like, this is the movie I want to make, and this is why, and this is how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And this is why you should want to help, and these are the people that's going to be in it. And that's the thing that, you know, I realize I'm very lucky to say that I can, you know, I can say Mark Romanek's in my film and John Landis and all these people, that's and cool. They have a name, you know, you have a name recognition.
Yeah.
But I really wanted the film to not feel like a famous person vehicle. Like, I really wanted it to feel like these people are talking about this place because they love this place. And so you have the regulars and the employees and the directors all have an equal FaceTime basically in the film. And I tried when I was editing it to whoever said it best. And that was really what I went with. And so it didn't matter who it was.
Right. That's great. I mean, well, it's a story. You tell the best story. So that's, was it hard to get these people?
No.
Like, let's say the directors was like talking to Kevin Smith, like, hey, Kevin, you want to be in my movie?
It well, I had built up a pretty good friendship with most of the people through the New Beverly, and I had never really dealt with anybody's assistant or manager or agent. It was always directly with that person.
That's incredible.
That's the key.
Yeah. So I was able to text Kevin Smith and say, hey, I'm doing this, you know, and so I know I don't want to sound like an asshole and just be like, everybody's phone number in my phone. I'm just like texting with Kevin Smith and like, it's cool. Like, I'm not, but it was cool that everybody really wanted to help, and everybody was really like, every interview went amazing, and everybody gave me incredible stuff. And I got to, Mark Romanek, I think, is an incredible filmmaker. Like, Never Let Me Go is a kick-ass film. And, you know, all of his music videos, and he's just really great. And he was really kind of intimidating to me because he's very serious, and he kind of, you know, he made me a little bit nervous. But we're going through, we're doing the interview, and then he started asking me questions and like turning it around and asking me. And I was like, because I was like, you know, 35 millimeters is really important. He's like, well, why? Why is it important to you? And I was like, so there's actually footage of me kind of like fumbling, trying to really like impress him with my, but he was the only one who kind of got like looked at the shot first and was like, maybe we could, and like trying to
promote
it. But his shot's amazing, and he was right to do it. And so, you know, because this was my first film. And so I think a lot of directors get stuck on the pride of, you know, I'm the director, and they don't want to appear weak or something. And so they don't ask for help. And I think a lot of first-time directors kind of fumble through by themselves, and you don't need to, you know. And I was very honest about telling my whole crew and telling everybody, like, you know, if you have any ideas or suggestions, let me know. And I think that made the crew feel like they were part of something as well, and they could say, oh, okay, well, I have this idea for this thing, and I'm like, let's do it. And so,
well, it's very big of you to do, because a lot of people won't do that.
Well, I don't see why you wouldn't, because that's what filmmaking's supposed to be, a kind of a group.
Yeah,
it's very collaborative.
It is. And I feel like kind of a fraud for saying I directed this movie and like, this is my movie, because it's not. It's everybody's movie. There were so many people that worked together to make this thing that I feel silly saying it's mine.
Right.
But
I hear you.
It's very nice of you. If I was on the crew, I would say thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, something with the Kickstarter as well, and why I wanted to raise so much money, is that I wanted to pay my crew fairly.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be able to pay the editor and pay, you know, the people who did the titles, and pay my brother who did the music, and he composed the whole score to the film, and he did an incredible job.
When you said the titles and the music, so cool. Like, was a lot of the stuff, did you pull anything from stock? Like,
yes.
Stock
set? We did a lot. I really wanted it to feel really kind of like the New Beverly. So to feel kind of choppy and dirty and messy, and there's but really bright and colorful and fun.
Yeah.
And so I used a website called Internet Archive, and they have a huge, huge selection of public domain stuff.
Oh, really?
And so every clip that you see in the film is public domain.
Let me write that down.
Yeah, Internet Archive. You know, but, and there's movies like Night of the Living Dead, which is public domain, and Plan 9 from Outer Space, and Charade, and these actual big movies that are public domain. And so I can use all those for free. And then they
have no idea.
They also had a huge selection of drive-in snipes. So the snipe is what, like, let's all go to the lobby. Those things, they're called snipes.
Okay.
And so they had a huge selection of vintage drive-in snipes. And so I ended up using those as, like, the...
Transitional period.
Thank you.
Yep.
Sorry, that word was not in my brain at that moment. The transitions are all old drive-in snipes. And those were all public domain as well.
Wow.
I think we're going to be making a movie of just that.
Yeah. And they're amazing. You're going to get sucked in.
Yeah.
Like, you go in there and you're in there for hours because there's just amazing amount of stuff. And we actually even pulled, there's in the film a small animated sequence that's from a 70s film strip about projecting. And so it's
film. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so it's actually, that's where it's from. And we found it in an archive.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
If you didn't have to shoot that footage, that would have been a nightmare and a half.
Well, it was just, you know.
Let's get this cross section of this camera. I mean, that's pretty much what it is.
Well, my aesthetic is very groovy. And I think that's one of the cool things about the movie that I didn't expect is that I feel like if you know me well, you can tell that I made this film. Like, it feels like very Julia to me. The whole title sequence and kind of the music and, just the feeling of, you know, just goofiness, I think. That was what I was trying. So
It was a lot of fun. I watched it at work.
Well, I feel like a lot of documentaries are really dry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't really need to be. I feel like you don't, because I was trying to think of like other like fun documentaries. And I was like, Exit Through the Gift Shop? Not that I'm putting myself there with that film, because that film's incredible.
Yeah.
Banksy's amazing.
The content has to be really fun, you know? Like, graffiti is fun to look at and the history of it, if you will. And your cruise movie as well is amazing, and I liked it a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah. And because you posted it for free, and you know, that's how I got to see it. And I was like, I have to talk to her because this is going to be a really cool interview. And it has been.
Thank you.
There was something else I was going to ask you about the interviews. As far as the sectioning of the movie being a documentary, did you have kind of an outline of what you were putting together?
No, I don't, because this is my first film again, I don't know how other directors edit, but how I did it was just kind of went through all of the footage, and there was like 60 hours of footage.
I was going to say, what's your shooting ratio?
Yeah, a lot.
Documentaries.
and there's so much amazing footage that, you know, and I really want to be able to put out a DVD with all of the special extras, because there's so much great stuff that we weren't able to put in the film.
Yeah.
But to go through once and just kind of write down the stuff that I liked, and then go through again and kind of whittle down. Yeah. The first cut of the film was 3 hours. I showed it to my parents. They fell asleep. So that didn't go very well. And then we got it down to 86 minutes. So it was finding the story within the footage, which was really tricky. And I'm still not as happy with it as I want to be. I mean, I imagine most directors, I would say, like,
never happy with
it, you know, and I feel like it's still a little more choppy than I'd like it to be, but that was the best way we kind of did. And this was, and I think there's a lot of people who didn't understand why I wanted to tell the New Beverly story. I think a lot of people said, you know, just talk about 35, like, this is a big issue, but it's such a big issue, I felt overwhelmed by it. And I felt like I can't tell this huge story, but I can tell this tiny story that leads to a bigger story. And that was kind of the idea behind it.
And the New Beverly being a tangible place for someone to go to and say, okay, this is what she's talking about.
Right.
I think it's more relatable than if you're just talking about 35 in general.
Right.
Nobody
but
can picture.
But of course, the punchline is that I got fired from the New Beverly. So,
which is unfortunate.
Yes.
And I read about that. Do you want to talk about that at all? You don't have to if you don't want to.
No, I mean, I feel like it's done. Like, I don't really have anything to say about it. But it's left me in a strange place, because I've always kind of expected the New Beverly to be in my life, and now it's not. So I have to kind of look forward and be like, okay, what's the next project? And that's the interesting thing is, like, I really have open doors. Like, I could do pretty much anything I wanted to if I set my mind to it, but I don't know, you know, another documentary or a feature or, like, who knows?
What do you like to do when you're not thinking about work, anything like that?
Watch movies.
Okay.
Right?
Be a reviewer. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Critic.
Film critic.
You just solved my problem, guys.
Yeah. You know, we're here to help.
That's what we do.
Well, you said earlier before we started recording that you really like horror movies.
I do.
Would you want to make a horror movie?
I actually, yes. I have a couple of screenplays that I'm working on, and a couple of them are actually horror films. One of my ideas, and I should probably, well...
You don't have to talk about it.
I don't know. Like, I don't... Does that happen? Do people actually steal other people's ideas? I don't know.
That's how we get our ideas. All of them. From our guests, yeah.
Every single one of them.
Yeah, I do. And I think it's been an interesting experience for me to be a female horror fan, because I feel like...
You're a rare breed.
Really underrepresented.
Yeah.
And my favorite horror film is Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one, the original one, followed by Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I'm not screwing around. Like,
we can be best friends.
I'm just saying, like, you know, I think a lot of times girls get this kind of, I don't know, they feel it. I don't understand where the other girl horror movie fans are.
Yeah.
They've all been killed off.
Well, my best friend Marion and I in college, we lived together, and there was this little video store by our house called Gold Star Video, and we made it our goal our senior year of college to watch every movie in the horror movie section at this video store.
Nice.
And there were 217, and we got through 175, so we almost made
That's
it.
That's awesome.
It's still pretty good.
But we watched 175 movies that year, and we started to do it because we were like, we want to survive. Like, we don't want to be the stupid girl who gets killed. Like, we want to, like, and so that it was like a survival training kind of. We're like, okay, don't go outside, and, you know, in your underwear. Don't say I'll be right back. Like, you know, and so, like, now we know. We saw so many films, a lot of really terrible films.
I'm sure. How many really did you terrible. Fast forward to?
We had a very pretty strict rule. Like, really? we were willing to sit through most stuff.
Wow.
And there were only a very few that we turned off. But there was a couple that we found. I found one, Fade to Black with Dennis Christopher, which came out in 1980, which is an amazing film. And it's actually very apropos to revival cinema, because it's about a horror movie fan whose line between fantasy and reality snaps, and he starts dressing up like these characters and killing people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is really cool. And Dennis Christopher's amazing in it. And then this movie called Final Exam, which is also from 1980, which has my favorite horror movie character of all time. His name is Radish, and he's a
sounds really, like a little rascal. Or something.
He's like a really geeky nerd, but he's a big horror fan, and he's like, they're coming for us. Like, he's always prepared, and so that it's look it up. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And one of the weird things is, because I saw that movie, I ended up showing it at the New Beverly because I loved it so much. And the director showed up, and I talked about how much I loved it and was going on about it. Then I got a phone call that next week that they were doing the DVD for Final Exam and wanted me to moderate the commentary because I was the biggest fan. And I was like, hell yeah.
That's so cool.
So
that's
actually awesome. If you get the DVD or Blu-ray of Final Exam, I'm the commentator on that track.
That's so awesome.
And I had a shirt that I made that said Radish Rocks that I would just wear. Like, that was just, I loved it so much. And I wore that shirt the day that I went, and the guy who plays Radish was there. And I think I really freaked him out because he was like, did you make that shirt for today? And I'm like, no, I just have this shirt. And he's like,
awkward.
Yeah, he didn't expect anybody to be a Radish fan.
Wow. It's do you know about Troll 2?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the same kind of thing. Like, what, you guys like me? Like, what's up with that?
It's
no
funny.
One's ever liked me before.
Yeah. It's funny to meet people from movies like that are not these, like, huge blockbuster movies that everybody talks about. Like, I love this movie called Chopping Mall.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Kelly Maroney.
Yep. And the first guy that dies in that movie is, I forget his name now, but when I worked at NBC, he's a director now for television. He came in for a meeting, and he's chewing gum just like he does in the movie the whole time. And I was just like, dude, I loved you in Chopping Mall. And he goes, yeah, I get that a lot. That and Deathstalker 2. I was just like, this is the best moment of my life. Because it's like this cult thing that we watched in high school. And then I tell my friends, like, I met the guy from Chopping Mall. And I met the...
And they think you're a superstar, don't they?
Oh, they're like, you got to be kidding me. Like, did you get photos? I'm like, no.
Didn't happen. Didn't happen if you didn't get photos.
But I think it's that special kind of people, too. Like, you know, I was with this group of people in high school, and that's the kind of thing we were into. But if I told other people that aren't the more of the mainstream stuff, they'd be like, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? So I don't know.
But that's what movie geeks like.
Man. I know.
Yep.
So exciting.
Our podcast is a little bit about education as well.
Okay.
Do you have any advice for anybody that is wanting to get into directing or writing or anything like
Ooh,
that?
Ooh, advice.
Yeah.
I mean, are you from here? What was your path to...
Okay, so I'm from Las Vegas. I was born and raised in Las Vegas.
Okay.
And I moved to California to go to college and then moved to Los Angeles 12 years ago. And I came here to be an actor. And I'm actually in, you can write this down, a full moon film. It's called Delta Delta Die. It's about cannibalistic sorority girls.
Oh, that's amazing.
I believe I've seen it.
Oh, well, I'm in it.
That's awesome.
That was one of my first films. And I came out with the intention of being a scream queen. I was like, I'm going to be in horror movies and it's going to be great. So I did this Delta Delta Die, and I actually, there's another film that I did with my best friend Marion called Golden Earrings, which is kind of a horror-esque kind of thing. So if you're out there and you need a scream queen, I got a really good horror movie scream as well.
Yes. Wait, can you give it to us?
No, it's way too loud. It would like blow your eardrums. I don't know, my path has been kind of weird because I started out as an actor and... only did the movie kind of, I'd never directed anything, but I just knew that I could. So I guess there's that. Like, yeah. If you think that you can do it, you probably can. But it does take a lot of organization. If you don't have very good organizational skills, that might be a problem for you.
Right.
I feel like, you know, a lot of scheduling and whatnot. But I think, you know, I guess talking about earlier, you know, asking your crew what they think and getting their opinions and making everybody feel like they're part of a team, I think is part of the goal of making a film, is that everyone can look back on this project and feel good about it and remember that it was cool to work on that. And I got to talk to, I met all these people and, you know, it was really fun and we all eat lunch together and, you know.
Make people comfortable to work with.
And, sure.
You know. Were there any unexpected things with it or surprises in terms of the process that people should know if they're going to make a documentary?
Going through all the footage was tiresome.
Yeah. And,
you know, 60 hours is...
How long did it take your editor to get through all that?
That wasn't my editor. That was me.
That was just you?
That was me going through all that footage.
Punishing yourself?
No. I mean, I felt like that was my job. Yeah. I feel like, you know, as a director, I wanted to go through and pick out the stuff that I wanted. And, you know, and that's because as a director, that's your job, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, to go through and say like, okay, I want this here and that there. And it was really interesting. I'd never edited a film, so to go through all the Final Cut Pro stuff and like learn, I mean, I don't know how to do it, but watch my editor do it.
Yeah.
And the music was really interesting as well. So my brother is a musician. He has a band, but he's never composed anything. And so when I got the money for the movie, I called him and asked him if he'd be the composer. And he said, I've never scored a film. And I'm like, I've never made a film. We'll figure it out together. And he had a hard job because when I was starting, I didn't know yet what the movie was. So I didn't have any direction to give him. Yeah. But he had to start composing. So he's like, what do you want? And I'm like, like air, I guess, like that kind of stuff, like kind of like ambient stuff.
Yeah.
And then halfway through the movie started getting really groovy and I was like, no, like James Brown. And so
nice.
If you listen to it, there's actually both in there and they both work. And he was able to do, like, my brother was able to do some funky tracks, you know, and it's like the stuff he does for his band is space rock. So it's kind of like, you know, dreamy Pink Floyd type stuff. And so this was really different and I thought it was really cool. And to see the movie with the music really makes it something different.
Yeah.
I also got music from the Internet Archive. They also have public domain music.
I love this website so much right now.
Yeah. Every filmmaker that's one of my big things there. If I can be helpful to any filmmaker, it's go to Internet Archive. And even if you can't use the footage, which you should be using for editing practice, but if you just watch stuff, there's so much cool stuff on there. a lot of real old movies and things.
Well, it's nice, like, if you have a shot where somebody's watching TV and you don't know what to put on the TV screen.
Put Nightmare
on,
or Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
There's no copyright there.
No. Yeah, it's surprising the amount of films that, I mean, because Charade is interesting. So Charade, the score is not public domain, but the film is. So you can use clips from it, but you can't use any audio.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, because, yeah.
I'd probably throw Plan 9 up there just because
that's. Oh, Plan 9's in there.
Such
I got
an
Freaks
movie.
In there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's a great movie. If you've never seen that, Andrew, you should watch Freaks.
About me?
Yeah.
Have you never seen Freaks?
No.
Wow.
So good.
I watched
so
Freaks and Geeks.
It's probably one of the scariest films of all time.
Oh, good. That'll go well for me.
Are you not a horror fan?
I have a deep appreciation for horror, but I do not like being scared.
So we forced
the first movie I ever made was a horror movie.
That's weird.
In high school. I know. Well, it's just like, I feel like that's what everybody does at first. Like, it's just the typical, like, let's make a slasher movie.
Mm.
And so
if
that's,
you're a boy, usually.
Yeah, and so that's what I did.
But
and then
more girls should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had girls in our movie. I mean, and they lived.
Oh.
Spoiler alert, one of them was the bad girl.
Oh.
And then the movie went and won an award.
Hey.
When I was in high school, so I was, but
congratulations.
I don't, thanks, but, you know, and then my next movie, I don't know, was that a horror
movie? Yeah, it was a thriller. It's a thriller, yeah.
I feel like it's,
but
like,
I don't know.
It's like riding a roller coaster. It's like those feelings of adrenaline without getting on a ride.
Yeah.
Right.
That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
But I understand.
And you're less likely to die. Maybe. No, it's just the, like, having things jump out at me and I don't know, but I love the, like, if just the process was just to make horror movies, I think that would be amazing.
Hmm.
And trying to figure out what would freak
me
out, which
takes
very little.
You'd be kind of a poser, though.
Like, I would be a poser.
I'm going to make horror movies, but I don't like horror movies. I'd be like,
I like watching some of them.
We have a scary movie night.
Nice.
Which you're more than welcome to come.
Oh.
Yeah.
When is it?
Well, whenever we plan it,
yeah.
we try to do one once every month, and then a new person comes in. They get to bring their own.
Oh,
so you would be able to pick something like Final Exam.
Hey,
to
Radish Forever.
Yeah, see, that would be fun. And so we just get in there and watch a movie.
What'd you watch last time?
Was it?
I think Let the Right One In was the last one.
Yep.
Which the internet, like Nadav, who's our other host, who's not here today.
He's a third mic.
He looked it up, just what's the scariest movie on Netflix, and that was the one that came
up,
and I didn't get freaked out by it, so I know it's not the scariest movie on Netflix, because I've watched it twice
is
now.
Is Oculus on Netflix? Because Oculus is scary.
I don't know.
It's so. Did you see it?
I haven't seen it
it's
yet.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so I went and saw it just blind. Like, I had seen the poster on the bus stop. That's it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is going to suck. Like, every modern horror film sucks. Like, you know, and I saw The Conjuring, and I've seen all these movies, and I'm like, they're lame.
Yeah. The End of
Oculus
Conjuring.
Oculus blew my mind.
Really?
It's so good. And it's Karen Gillan is in it. She was in Doctor Who. And she's so amazing. She's, like, probably the best horror movie heroine since Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street, in my opinion.
Wow.
Like, she's getting it done.
Those
she
are like
knows
fighting
what she's
words.
Doing. I know. It's really clever, and they use a lot, there's a lot of practical effects, and it's just really scary and well done, and it, like, blew my mind, and I was really, really impressed with it. So, highly recommended.
Maybe.
All right.
Maybe we'll see that.
I do go to Scary Movie Night.
That's true.
And I sit
That's
through
true.
It.
Have you seen Annabelle yet?
No.
Yeah, I haven't either.
I don't really want to.
Really?
I've heard it's bad.
Oh, man, that
you know,
sucks. Because it has so much potential.
But that's the thing. They always have so much potential.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you take these stories and I'm like, come up with something so much scarier than that. Like, why is, you know.
Yeah. Well, see, that's what I should be doing. Yeah, you should make a horror movie.
To be honest, there's one that I'm writing that I think would do really well, and I'm kind of afraid to write it because of the place I'd have to go to write it, and that sounds really pretentious, but...
You mean, like, emotionally?
Well, so the idea is, and I'm not giving away too much to here, but most of the dialogue would be actual serial killers, what they've actually said.
Oh, okay.
Because I was wondering, I was talking about Charlie Manson with a friend of mine, and then I was like, has any serial killer ever written an autobiography? Because I'd be really interested to figure out why you would do these things. And that's the most interesting thing about them, right?
Yeah.
And there hasn't, but there's a book that I found that's just collected writings and of serial killers, basically. Mm-hmm, so like letters that they found or court statements or anything. And it's horrifying. It's really terrible. But so I was using that dialogue as the dialogue. So it would actually be, you know, somebody, words, Albert Fish said this. Yeah. And, you know, the Boston Strangler said this. And, but, you know, it would all be in a dialogue. So you wouldn't know.
Right.
But that's a dark place.
It is.
But it's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
It is.
I love the true, like, Zodiac and, you know, stuff where it's really based on, because you know, you're like, this is not just a story, like, this happened.
And it really is the why, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're like, how does that happen? How does a person think it's okay? And, like, how does your mind, like...
And that's the scariest part about it, because you don't know, and it's like having no motive in a film.
Yes.
Like, why are they killing? Oh, I don't know. They're crazy.
Yeah.
And that's all. That's all you need.
Which sounds like a cop-out, but it's like, that's what it is. They're just crazy.
Oh, the Zodiac spurred something in my head, and I can't remember what it was.
That time we went to San Francisco and went shopping together?
We never went to San Francisco.
Oh, we should go.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Dexter. Like, I think, I don't know if you watched Dexter at all. But I think that's kind of not similar, but the fact that people really liked that show because it was something that wasn't normal and people weren't used to. It's just kind of an interesting, it's dark and taboo and you're not supposed to like this, but it's interesting.
That's why it's cool. I think it's an awesome challenge for a filmmaker to take somebody that should be a villain and get the audience on that person's side.
Did you ever watch Devil's Rejects?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I mean, they play a little dynamic with...
Ken Furry's in that.
He is.
Hey.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, the bad guys are kind of the central character in that movie, and which I think is really an interesting concept to do. But
well, there's been... I mean, you have something like a Maniac... You know, or Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and you have, you know, they're the kind of heroes of the film, even though they're monsters.
Right.
I think those are the best kind of serial killer movies. And serial killer movies shouldn't be fun.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of the other hard part.
It's like, romanticizing it.
Yeah. Do you want to write, do you want to write a movie that's not fun? I don't know. Like, I feel like fun is so important to me. That sounds super duper dorky. Fun's important
I like
to
fun.
Me.
Fun is neat.
But like, you know, I can't, Out of Print is such a fun film.
It is, yes.
It'd be so weird to be like, okay, now I'm going in this horrible, like, direction.
Yeah.
Maybe not good for the psyche.
Hmm.
I'm into it. If you ever make it, I want to see it.
Well, it would be, the reason I would be interested to make a horror film. It's just to show that women can. Like, I can make a horror film that's just as scary and screwed up than as any other, you know, movie. And just because I'm a girl doesn't make a difference. Like, I'm just as big of a gore hound as anybody else. So,
yeah.
Yay for girls.
Yeah.
Do you feel as a woman that it's more difficult to get something made, or is it less difficult because it's, you know, there are more male filmmakers? Or
no, I never felt any sexism ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the other thing is, like, as much as I'm like, I want to be show that women can be cool and women filmmakers, I also feel like, I think it's weird when women set themselves apart like that. Mm-hmm. I think, like, when you're like, oh, it's a women's film festival. I'm like, well, but is it good?
Yeah.
That's all I care about. Like, is the film good?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter if it's a boy or a girl, if they're black or white or whatever. Like, it should just be, is the film good? So that's how I see it. And, I had a point and it's gone now.
I got it. It makes sense.
Sweet. Well, thank you for being on the show today.
You're so welcome. Thank you. This was really fun. I'm so glad we got to talk about horror movies that, like, made my day.
Oh, awesome.
My boyfriend doesn't like them.
Oh,
so
geez.
I can't, like, show him anything and it drives me crazy.
The only thing, I was dating a girl for a while. The only thing she would watch was The Walking Dead, And granted, The Walking Dead is amazing. I love the show, but it's so tame compared to the stuff I've seen in life that it's...
And in movies
that it's like, I don't know. I feel for you.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're going through. Yeah. Well, Scary Movie Night, you're more than welcome.
I like it.
You can drag him here and say it's something else.
That'd be hilarious.
And just surprise him.
What would be amazing is if you bring, what is it, Delta Delta Die, and you just don't tell anyone. and we just throw it on, and people start looking at you like, wait a second.
Hey, wait a minute.
Is that you? Are you a cannibalistic sorority girl? I sure am.
You break out the silverware.
Oh, I got to get covered in a bucket of blood in that movie as well, which was like crossed off the bucket list. That, amazing.
The blood bucket list?
Yeah. The blood bucket list.
Literally.
So what did they what did they use?
It was corn syrup, Diet Coke for coloring.
Really?
And then also red food coloring. It was really cold and sticky. And I tried to, so they had to lead me, this is the behind the scenes of getting covered in a bucket of blood, folks. They had to lead me to a bathroom to take a shower right afterwards because I'm just covered.
Sure.
And I'm trying really hard not to touch anything because I know that I'm just disgusting.
Yeah.
And when I got out, it just looked like a murder crime scene in there. There was just blood everywhere. And I was like, I didn't touch anything.
One tip that one of our previous podcast interviews gave us was putting liquid soap in the blood. So
that's
comes
a,
out.
Well, that's a different kind of blood because this had to be okay to go in my mouth.
Oh, okay.
With and with liquid detergent, that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
So how did that taste?
Sweet.
Oh,
well, it had the syrup.
But if you watch the footage, the director. So I'm like, am I like horrified by this? And he's like, no, you're kind of into it. And I'm like, all right. So like,
oh, nice.
That was the direction. So kind of into it.
Sweet.
Yeah. The movie I did in high school, we had Karo syrup and red food coloring. We bought it. And the guy at the store was like, making a lot of blood tonight, huh? And we're like, I guess so. And then we shot a bunch of it in our garage and there's just bloody footprints everywhere on so the concrete sticky. And moved out of the house. I don't know. 15 years later, they're still, it's just never coming out.
Yeah.
It's there forever.
It's messy stuff.
We'd be like, we don't know what happened in here.
There was no murder.
Can we get an exorcism or something?
Pay no attention to these bloody footprints.
To the bloody Skecher shoe footprints. Where can people find your movie?
You can find it online. It is, well, you can go to outofprintfilm.com. And
nice.
There's a link. We're also, you know, obviously Twitter, Facebook, whatnot. And follow me, and maybe you'll get to find out what I'm going to do next, because I sure don't know. Who knows, folks? There's
nothing wrong with that.
No?
Nothing wrong with that.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.